Folks, welcome to the Jake Feinberg Show. And melodic invention is at the core of what my guest does. He communicates in waves that even he may choose not to ride too long. For music to be good, it has to swing. For music to be great, it has to elevate the consciousness of the listeners. It has to be inclusive and team-oriented, with a special attention to auditory reception of the modal patterns that my guest has been laying down for the last 40 years. Modalities exist in cosmic melodic invention, the kind that was made by my guest and all his cohorts, Buster Williams, Freddie Waits, with Renee McLean, Howard King, Stafford James, and Gary Bartz in the N2 Troupe, steaming with Reggie Lucas and M. Tume. Hubert Eaves, it's been a long time. Welcome to the Jake Feinberg Show.
Thank you. Finally, we get a chance to get together and speak and get a chance to meet some people as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's happy 4th of July. I wanted to ask you, right now, a chance to reflect back. Do you feel like you have stayed true to your soul and the music? How hard of a balancing act has it been to survive commercially versus what you really want to say?
Well, I pride myself on doing what I feel, and I feel it all. I mean, when I say all, I mean, of course, I have my limitations as well. But I mean, in terms of if you're talking specifically about jazz versus commercial music, let's narrow it down. I love both. So I came up, playing the blues in the clubs, for a beer.
Yeah, right.
Playing dances. I used to play drums in bands where, with dances and so forth, R&B things. So, I'm very comfortable there, as well as, the time that I spent learning jazz and coming up in my father's barbershop, working there, cleaning up, and he had all the latest jazz hits of the day, on the jukebox. So, I heard all of that, and I'm a reflection of all of that, and I feel very natural and comfortable with it.
You I tend to focus back on this time when you got your generation really growing up. I mean, the amount of, well, first of all, when that music was going on in the barbershop, I mean, did you guys refer to it as jazz? I mean, I know like guys like Duke and Dizzy, they didn't even call it jazz. I'm just curious about, I'm very interested in terminology at this point in my research. I was curious as if is that what you guys referred to as jazz?
Yes, there was no doubt about it.
And
at that time,
right. So, and it was considered, at that time, a true African-American art form at that time.
Yeah.
Because yeah, I wonder... Go ahead.
I was going to say that was the music of people like Eleanor Jacquette and Gene Ammons and Miles Davis and so forth. And, which was one of my dad's, like Eleanor Jacquette happened to be one of my dad's heroes, which is why he had him on the jukebox. And it's just ironic that when I moved to New York, I ended up living right across the street from Eleanor Jacquette. So
was just by coincidence. Wow.
Coincidence, yeah. When my dad came to visit me, I introduced him to Eleanor, and my dad was shaking and nervous as if he was going to meet Michael Jackson or somebody.
Right, that would be the equivalent of me meeting like Hubert Eaves or something. No, I'm kidding. The thing is, I got to tell you, but why was he a hero to your father?
Why? What was that again? I'm sorry.
Why was Eleanor Jacquette a hero to your dad?
Oh, because my dad is, he's 89, and at that point he was probably in his late 70s, and so he came up with jazz and Duke Ellington and so forth. That was what was on the radio at the time in the 40s and 50s when he was coming up, and that was considered commercial music then. he was more of a jazz listener most of his life. Back then they kind of heard it all because, you know, it was race music back then, so a lot of things didn't get heard. But a lot of the jazz stuff was heard because it's, you know, it was on the radio.
It was considered popular music.
Yeah.
When you talk about race music, can you go talk a little bit more about that? I mean, I was born in 78, I'm trying to figure out, were there radio stations that you could hear this race music? Talk a little bit about what that meant at that time.
Well, you know, the race music, this was even really before my time, a lot of it, was basically that, you know, there were songs that were being cut by black artists, but they were not able to get them played. And they were only played, you know, locally within the black clubs and so forth, and within the black neighborhoods and so forth. And then certain artists, white artists, would come along and then they would recut them, you know, somebody to say like Elvis Presley, for example, and they would be huge hits, some of them.
Right.
And so there was that kind of a separation that was going on at the time. You know, that was, you know, back at the time when there was a really obvious race situation problem going on. So, of course, the music just reflected that.
So essentially, like, somebody might cut a 45 or like some, and then that record might get played in the clubs or on local radio, but it would never get to the point where a record company would sign that artist.
No, and if they did, you know, the kind of monies that they got were so trivial to the point where you know, they never got the exposure that they could get out, that the counterparts got. Like, you know, you take somebody like Pat Boone, you know,
right.
he did a lot of that. He covered a lot. You know, you can't necessarily blame Pat Boone or blame necessarily the artists, the white artists. It was the companies that was running it, and they were crafting it in that way because they were making money. The artist basically just appreciated the you know, the art, artistry and the soul of what was coming out of the black communities, and you know, it was all a natural thing. Music was always natural.
Yeah, no, it's beautifully put. I talk about your dad's barbershop and the neighborhood that you grew up in. St. Paul in Minnesota, is that correct?
Yeah, St. Paul and Minneapolis. Yeah.
In Minneapolis. So, I mean, you know, you're the first cat I've talked to from Minnesota, but I mean, I think, but maybe one other one, but I mean, I've covered, talk a little bit about the regional music of Minnesota, I mean, you know, or Minneapolis. I mean, you had, Chicago had its own unique scene, Detroit did, Philly, New York, that was one of the most special things about when you were coming of age, just the idea that we were not all interconnected. And talk a little bit about the neighborhood, the scene, and the kind of, maybe if there was a club or two that really paid homage, and you might have seen some of these titans, like, you know, I don't know, Bird, Coltrane, come through, and or Illinois Jacquette, and play in within your neighborhood.
Yeah, I would say when I was coming up in St. Paul, I was a teenager, probably 16, 17 years old. I didn't really, at that point, see many jazz artists, you know, because I guess about the first thing that I heard that inspired me to really listen to jazz, aside from my dad's barbershop, was Take Five.
Mm-hmm.
The song Take Five.
Sure.
As well as Poinciana by
Ahmad Jamal.
The Yama Jamal.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so those type of things. But I didn't really see those artists. You know, the artists that I did see that really impressed me the most at that point, which is kind of where my head was at that time, was James Brown. And because I played drums and I always liked the rhythm of everything, and I came up to rhythm and blues. So, but there weren't a lot of bands that played jazz to 20. I was married at 18, which I'm still married at this point for 48 years.
Congratulations, and, man. That is serious. I mean, I've been married for 8 years, and that's incredible.
Yeah, well, I got 40 on you. So 48 years.
Wow,
my wife's beautiful. We both, you know, we have a beautiful relationship. So
bless you, man.
But yeah, and congratulations to you too.
Thank you, man.
Yeah, but what I would say is that once I moved to Minneapolis, which is where she's from, I got exposed to more of the jazz, and I think. From what I remember most is my dad took me, he wanted me to get away from the rhythm and blues, and because he saw that I was starting to get a little too comfortable and I wasn't being challenged or challenging myself.
Oh, interesting, okay.
So he inspired me to go, and he took me to a club, a jazz club, where they had a young kid who was leading a trio, and this young kid's name was Bobby Lyle.
Wow.
And Bobby Lyle was one of the only jazz greats that I know of that came out of there. But when I saw Bobby was a few years older than me, when I saw Bobby, I knew immediately that's what I wanted to do. And I just proceeded in trying to do that. And I got a chance to talk with Bobby, and you know, Bobby was kind of like one of my main inspirations. And so from that, it led to, you know, just trying to work to try to get to that kind of level of proficiency on the instrument and listening and talking to different guys. And I started meeting more jazz musicians in Minneapolis. Even though they weren't famous, a lot of them were really great players, and a lot of them had other little problems, you know, and which held them back. But it didn't, when they played their instrument, you really heard that they could have gone. They could have made it if they had chosen to, if they hadn't had other obstacles to deal with.
Most of your brotherhood are unsung heroes, and then a lot of them have never gotten, you know, there were guys that sounded just like Bird or were doing other things, in all cities in the country, and they just never, I mean, because there wasn't the internet and television and you know, just they stayed regionally very well known, but never, or drugs or whatever it was that knocked them down. But you know, but going back to Bobby Lyle, you said you saw him and said, that's what I want to do. Was he also like, aside from his technical proficiency, was he just a great entertainer as well? I mean, did you gravitate to him because of his personality as well?
I wasn't so interested in that. I knew he was a nice kid. You know, I looked up to him, and he really came from a really good, strong, foundational family and so forth. I was just so impressed by the music.
What was it about it? Because your dad motivated you to get there. Was it just the idea of having the melodic invention in your ears? What was it that was so scintillating for you?
The fact that here he was, this young kid, he's probably 67, maybe 18 at the time, and he was playing a swing trio.
Right.
And playing using both hands, the left hand, chordal, playing chords with his left hand, and plus soloing, he had an incredible right hand, and he was able to control the band. You know, he was the one who determined what the melodies were in terms of the beginnings of the song, intros, the endings, and so forth. And they were all one, but I mean, he was the focal point. And you know, I had been playing basically in St. Paul with rock groups and R&B groups, basically playing with one hand. And, you know, all of a sudden I realized I got two hands that I need to be using. And so that to me made it, you know, something that was really worth checking out. And it was inspiring for me to, you know, to get challenged in that way. I also love the feel. I love the feel of the music. I just, you know, it was a natural thing for me.
Right, it was a feel. It was the, I mean, in your mind, what was that feel? Was it European music blending with African rhythms. I just really want to get to the core of this time, only because I just feel the way the word jazz is used today, in the current industry. I want to delineate between how jazz has morphed into whatever it is today versus what it was at that time, because there was a spiritual quality and a historical quality to the music that I find has been sort of losing steam, so to speak. And I would really want to know what you were feeling, why it was a natural feel.
Okay, let me set that up by saying this. I heard something recently. This has nothing to do necessarily with jazz. This is with the artist Otis Redding.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard an old recording of his, and I just happened to be listening to it, and I was listening really intently and seeing how these guys, when they played even in an R&B situation, they played in a way where they listened to each other, they responded to each other, and they made up instant arrangements that were made up right then and there on the spot. And if they did something, let's say first take, while they were recording or rehearsing, and they liked it, they fed off of it, and they enhanced it, and then they did variations of it, and they really worked it to a point where it became a piece of art, so to speak, within that music. And that's the same thing that was happening in jazz. There was no electronics. You know, this was before, when I'm talking about when I heard Bobby and the different guys like Ahmad Jamal or Oscar Peterson or McCoy Tyner and Miles' groups with Herbie Hancock and so forth. There was no real electronics going on. You dealt with, you know, what was there. The instruments were pure and live, and the arrangements were, you know, you had nothing to enhance them to necessarily, like, you know, electronic strings or
right.
Electronic percussion like we do now. And so you were forced to really listen and pay attention, and you loved the people that you worked with. You knew them well. A lot of times you knew their families, and so you got a chance to really melt and become like one. And that's what I always loved about jazz, and I loved about jazz musicians. They have a totally different kind of an outlook, even on life and how they deal with each other, respect, that I don't see now that I've, you know, because I've had a chance to work within the commercial market. I've even been in the gospel market and done things there, and I just, there's definitely a separation that I have and appreciation that I have for the jazz music, the jazz and musicians, and the struggles and the joy and the love that comes out of that.
Right.
And I don't know if I've completely answered your question.
Well, no, I mean, you have, because, well, in some ways you have, because I'm going back to this time where, like, again, you're right, it was acoustic. It was before the electronics, although the ironic thing is you were one of the pioneers of incorporating. Like, you're not never afraid to incorporate any type of device, you know. I mean, that was the and I look at this. I would like you to. I mean, is it just in the commercial, as you've gone through, whether it's working with hip hop groups or soul, R&B and soul, whatever it is, as you go through, you know your more recent career, there the outlook of more contemporary or commercial art is the artist's their perspective is more business. Is it just not as wide open, and is it like, because you don't know their families, it's less intimate, and people are more afraid to actually just listen? I mean, that's the point, is that the listening is key. I think that was one of the things. I mean, you go back to these groups that you were in, all, you know, records that you were on, or live performances, just seems like the ability to listen, it was there, and that to me speaks to a value set of basically saying we're all in it together. Coltrane kind of, you know, that kind of mentality of love pushing forward for positive things, whereas now listening, no, not so much. It's more about the individual. The ego has, the individual has gotten bigger than the music, and that
yeah.
I can feel that, even though I'm only 35. I mean, I can feel that. I just want to get your thoughts on, you know, on that, because you've been in both worlds.
Well, I can even feel it within myself. I've done things more recent, you know, in the past say maybe 10, 15 years or so, that I saw where I gotten too far away from the things that, you know, that I was brought up in, that I felt naturally, or what even brought me to New York, and that was that sensitivity and the listening and the being able to be more acoustic in terms of approach. And so I've had to, you know, kind of back myself up as well. And I'm always listening for that, because that's what has made me fortunate in that I've been in the different worlds, because I'm able to notice it, pinpoint it is the word I was looking for. And so it's easier for me to hear it. And then once I hear it, then it's a matter of what am I going to do with it? Right. Am I going to continue on, or am I going to do like I'm working on a solo project that I started a while ago, which involves electronics and acoustic. So, you know, I got to, even within those projects that I'm, you know, currently working on, I have to be mindful of that, and not lose that. So, it's the kind of thing where I really have to consciously be aware of it.
So, I'm curious, when did you decide, or what was the impetus? What was the first band? Did somebody offer you a gig, and that's why you went to New York, or you just went there and said, "I'm gonna go check the scene out"? And then, who did you get connected with when you first got there?
Well, I moved from Minnesota. I went to California first.
Oh, you
I
did.
Decided that I had had enough. The music scene in Minnesota was just. I felt like, not so much that I had outgrown the music, but I outgrew the musicians, and I outgrew the camaraderie that we did not have. There was just not enough there, and the people that were there that you got a chance to play with, even if they were some great players, I felt they weren't consistent at that particular time enough to. It was just too frustrating, you know, all the time to try to. I will say, at that time, I was really intense about what I was doing. So I was trying to learn how to write and trying to learn how to play. So I moved to California, took my family to California, and played out there for a couple of years out in San Bernardino. I had a jazz group, we played jazz as well as a little R&B dance stuff.
I need to know who was in that trio. Please let me know who was in that trio.
Oh, okay. Well, this was actually, at the time, it was a guy named my brother-in-law, Clyde Parker.
Clyde Parker. Yeah,
he played guitar.
Okay, so the trio was piano, guitar, drums. Is that what it was?
Yeah, it was actually piano, guitar, and drums.
What
and
a great
I
setup!
Left-handed bass.
You played the bass.
Yeah,
oh, I love it. I love it.
At the time.
What year was it? What years was it?
This was in about 1968.
Oh, this is unbelievable. So, I mean, did you feel like when you got out there, aside from your group, obviously you had elevated into a different regional area? Did you meet a lot of really great musicians? Because, I mean, things were really percolating at that time in California.
I didn't meet them where I was at. I was in a little small town called San Bernardino. And I was the local band, and we played six nights a week, I think it was six nights a week. So I was busy. But on my off night or so, I would go to L.A.
Mm.
And that's where I met the guys from New York, you know, that were always my heroes, that I always listened to on the radio and so forth, and the Freddie Hubbard and people like that. And at that time, it was I can't think of the name, but the CTI folks at the time.
Yeah, well, like George Benson or Ron Carter and
I went to a few of those concerts and so forth. And then when I would come back, I would always be, you know, kind of like, well, impressed. And so one night I was playing in the club, and this guy walks out of his name is Fitz Jenkins. He's an acoustic bassist. And he comes up to me and he said, listen, man, you know, I would really like to, he said, I love what you're playing and the way you're playing. He said, but I'd like to free your left hand up so that you wouldn't have to do that, to play the bass. He said, I'm a bassist. So he, I said, well, yeah, let's try it. So he came up and brought his bass, and we started working. We started, and he was from New York. So we started working together, and then we would talk during the breaks, and he would tell me about New York, and I would ask him questions, and he would see that my eyes were wide open, and he would tell me, you know, you should come on to New York. If you come, you can stay with me, and so on and so forth. And meanwhile, I thought about a conversation I had with McCoy Tyner when I was in Minnesota before I left to California. I happened to have had a house trio at a club called the Cafe Extraordinaire.
Mm.
And that was where I forgot about that. That's where I got exposed to all the guys like McCoy Tyner. I got a chance to play with Freddie Hubbard, Rahsaan Roland Kirk.
Wow.
Wow. Joe Henderson.
Woo!
They all came there.
That's great.
And I was the house trio.
Right.
So I got a chance to talk to those guys. So I asked McCoy once, I said, you know, I'm afraid to come to New York. I got to be honest with you. There's so many good guys, so many bad cats, is what I said to him. And I said, man, and I'm intimidated by that. He said, well, you know, there's a lot of bad cats in New York. He said, but if you come, you'll be one. And I never thought of it like that. And but he did. I reflected back on that conversation when I was speaking to my guy Fitz in California, and he kept saying, come on, I got a place for you. You can stay with me. It's just a one-room apartment, but, you know, until you get yourself straight, you know, you can stay there. So at a certain point,
I just want to stop. I want to stop you 1 second. So Fitz Jenkins, he was just there doing some other engagement, and he happened to see to walk into the club that you were playing in, and then he wanted to play the bass in your band. How did that? I mean, he was there. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Fitz was there going to school at Loma Linda. He was a doctor going to school for medicine.
So but you were gonna, you had at some point say to your wife, listen, I gotta go, I'm gonna go to New York, do I have your blessing? And, cause it was only a one room apartment, it wasn't like you were gonna bring your whole family back there.
No, well, when I went to New York, I drove my family, cause we sold everything that we had, the little stuff that we had in California, we sold it all. I had a car, I drove it to Minnesota, and with the understanding, I told my dad that I had this car, which was a nice car, that I got a good deal on it, you know, and so my dad said that he would buy the car, so I decided, well, I would take that money and use that to get to New York.
Sure.
In the meantime, my wife and kids, once I drove them there, they were able to stay with my mother-in-law. I had the two kids, and once they stayed there, I had my wife get on the welfare because we had no, you know, no money.
Right.
So she stayed on the welfare for 1 month while I was in New York. And when I came to New York, I came by myself, and the guy Fitz met me there, and I was blown away by it. The first day I came to New York, I was like, oh my God, what took me so long?
This isn't San Bernardino anymore.
Oh, no, but I fell in love with it the first day. I mean, some people say they hate New York when they come, and how could you live there? I was in love with it from day one. And I stayed there for a month. I found a friend who had a singer who had a place, and they were going away to sing in Greenland, and they needed someone to watch their apartment, and they could stay rent-free until the singer came back. And so I took that. And then brought my family in.
Wow. How they were going for how long? Like a month or two?
Yeah, it was about 3 months.
That's a nice, that's pretty nice connection. I should say I am from Stony Brook, Long Island. So, I mean, I've never lived in the city, but, yeah, I mean, the city was different then too. I mean, it was my folks. They bought a house in Long Island in 71, but they said the city was a little ragged at that time. But in some ways, that looseness, or the idea that, you know, slugs, the Tin Alley, you know, Folk City. What I love is that places stayed open much later, so that you would have jam sessions, and it wouldn't be a surprise if Rahsaan or you know, Sam Rivers or anybody Miles would show up at these things and play with the younger cats. And just because the name of the club was like Folk City didn't mean that you couldn't have Elvin Jones's quartet in there. There just seemed to be a lot more fluidity and flexibility and vibrancy right at that time. So maybe you can fill that in for me.
Yeah, well, one thing that I noticed when I was in California, if someone was big, had a big name, they were really famous for whatever, it was obvious you knew who they were.
Right.
It was obvious by the way that they dressed, by the automobile they drove, the whatever. When I came to New York, it was completely the opposite. Someone could be huge, and you would never know it. It just wasn't an obvious braggadocious type of thing, even in terms of color. Just think in terms of color. California had colors. And I'm not talking racial, I'm talking just color.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah, and when you came to New York, everything was pretty much drab. You know, so the colors of clothes and so forth, and the colors of, you know, the streets, the different things, that's the way I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to just paint my picture. And so you could be sitting on the train, and you could be sitting next to whoever, the owner of whatever, major whatever, and you would never know it. You know what I mean?
Right, it was, you know, there was a lot of glitz and glamour. Why? What was that about? I mean, I think that visually, like, you're painting that picture in your mind. I think it's accurate, but that selflessness, or that idea of saying, well, it's not. You're really, you know, you might be a major star, but you know, it's not. You don't need to flaunt it. I mean, is that kind of what you're saying? People did not need to go out there and say, look how big I am.
Right. That's exactly what I'm saying, and then they would go and with their craft. In the case of musicians, once you heard them, then you're like, "Oh my God, that's so and so!" Or, "Wow, listen to that!" You know, and that's really blew my mind about New York, because you'd be in local clubs, and I came at a great time. And when I look back about it, it was a great time because a lot of the major jazz artists that contributed the most were, you know, they were still around.
Absolutely.
I remember once getting a chance. I was playing in a local club, and I was playing with a guy named Bill Lee, which happens to be Spike Lee's dad.
I know. I see him on all. It's funny. I see him on all different types of records. I know him well. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I'm playing with him and Cecil. What's Cecil's last name? The baritone player. I can't think of his name right now.
But go ahead. Continue.
And so anyway, we're playing in a little local club on a little local street, and in walks Thelonious Monk, and it's his birthday. And so he was the cousin of Bill Lee, so that's why he came there. Now,
wow.
We're playing around midnight, so one of the highlights of my career, to me, is the fact that I was able to play around midnight for Thelonious Monk on his birthday, and when we finished, he just gave me the nod.
That's right.
He didn't have to say anything, he just gave me the nod.
It's one of the most sophisticated, I mean, I just think, looking back on it, being that I'm a 35-year-old journalist trying to chronicle this period of time, I don't look at it like in any way. When I think of you guys, I say, boy, you guys were blessed to go through that time, because Max Roach and Dizzy, Cannonball, Train, Miles, Hubbard. I mean, some of the Titans are still obviously cranking it out today, but those cats, the Titans, were still around. So you could taste Thelonious, Billy. You had that. They were still. They had bands. The record industry was still thriving. So there were. You guys could have identities. I mean, and the humbleness of the cats. I mean, it's like, don't talk, just play. To me is like that. I mean, we're void of that. There's nothing going on like that now. Although I will say this, we went to Taiwan, my family. I came back by myself before the rest of my family, and I got a chance to spend a week out in Southern California to see Henry the Skipper Franklin, Alphonse Mouzon, Azar Lawrence. And that kind of brought back the spirits a little bit. I mean, that revitalized me a little bit because they were listening. You know, it was a nice picture. But that authenticity, that realism, and that accessibility to your heroes—the idea that Monk would just sit down in front of you and nod—that's a pretty that's pretty invigorating and empowering, I would think.
Yeah, I got a bunch of stories like that, which, you know, I'm going to be in the process of writing a book too, because I just feel like I want my grandkids and so forth to know, you know, what it was like. And, you know, especially since some of them are into music as well. But another story I remember, we did, I was with Gary Bartz in 1973.
Yes.
And we went to do the Montreux Jazz Festival in Switzerland. And I remember we were just rehearsing, just getting ready, you know, rehearsing what we were going to do, because it's a live recording. And Cannonball walks into the rehearsal, Cannonball Adderley and Matt.
Yes.
And as a result, you know, we played our performance and so forth. And I get back from that in about a week's time, and I get a call, and it's Cannonball's managers, and they're asking if I would join his band.
Wow.
And that's just from him coming into a rehearsal, sitting in, not saying a word. Just listening.
Right.
And next thing I know, I get a call to join the band. And I wouldn't leave. I didn't want to do it because I was in love with being Pierre Bunch's band. At that time, we had such a chemistry. And we all kind of lived in the same block. And, you know, we just, you know, it was just too perfect of a situation. And I didn't want to leave. But.
No, I want to. You're hitting on all. First of all, I'm staring at the only reason I'm even. Well, I shouldn't say the only reason, but I'm staring at that album right now on LP. You know, the live show from Montreux with you guys.
Right.
And you know, I mean, it was a genius decision by somebody, because a lot of those shows were taped. McCoy's group with Azar, Alphonse, and Junie Booth was recorded. Your group. That's the thing that was so magical, is that out of that listening, out of the humbleness, out of the security, grew bands. Like bands that you would stay with for considerable amount of time. So if this is very important, when I interviewed Gary way back when, he talked about it, but talk a little bit about how that group came together. It's just amazing to me that Stafford, you, Howard King, and Gary all lived on the same block. But, I mean, talk about what you knew before N2 Troop and maybe the values and the spiritualism and the love that grew out of that, things that you took away from being in that collective. Because it was, you guys were so tight, and you were channeling spirituality as well.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it started for me in California before I went to New York. I went to a neighborhood store, record store, and I picked up the Gary Bartz album, N2 Troop. No, it wasn't N2 Troop at the time. I forget what the name of it was, but it was a Gary Bartz album, and I picked it up for about 99 cents. You know, back then, I used to have records.
Love it. Love it.
Yeah, so I got it for 99 cents, and I would bring it home, and I would play it, and I was just blown away by the feel of it. It just, Andy Bay was playing piano on it, and he was singing as well as Gary.
Wow.
And Junie Booth was playing, and a guy named Harold White was playing drums. And I believe that's his name, but anyway, it had such a groove to it. The swing on it was just so loose and so natural, and it just felt so good that that's when I got exposed to Gary. And so I'm a fast forward.
Right.
Once I got to New York, this was even before we all lived on the same block.
Right.
I went to perform, to hear Gary in a club. And at the time, he had a guitarist with him, along with Howard King, which was his drummer, who happened to be about 16 at the time.
Very young cat, yeah.
And Stafford James was playing bass. But they were limited as to what they could do with the guitars, because, you know, he had been pretty much a commercial guitarist, and at that time Gary was starting to dibble with the commercial music.
Right.
So, anyways, I asked him, could I sit in? And
what club was it? Do you remember what club it was at? Was it at some small place, or where was it?
Yeah, it was a club called the Jazz Boat.
Okay, so you just you introduced yourself and just said, "Can I sit in? I'm a pianist."
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Okay.
And back then, you know, it was easy, to sit in. I was used to that. I always loved sitting in places, you know, just to kind of. I was just so used to it because I was trying to make a name for myself and get to know people, and at the time, I kind of knew what the songs of the day was, let's say, so to speak. You know, once you knew a certain amount of standards. You know, as long as you could play the tempos and the different keys and so forth, you could, you could sit in if somebody knew you. But so they took a chance. And once we, you know, I sat in, Howard King and I, the drummer, because I was an ex-drummer as well, and I played very rhythmic, we kind of locked in immediately. And we were just, you could tell, because we were smiling back and forth with each other. And then Gary would look around, and he starts smiling, and I'm thinking to myself, this is the same Gary Bartz that I loved so much before I came to New York, and here I am sitting and playing with him, so I'm on cloud nine, and I'm just listening to how we all having fun and playing together, and next thing I know, they asked me would I join the band.
That is, see, that's the kind of story that is going to be documented in my book and for years to come in the universe of the extraterrestrial radio system of the internet, because it was totally organic. Nothing was forced. And
Right. And
the security, again, it goes back to a value set, because I'm not saying that there aren't jam sessions now in New York, there are plenty, but the idea of the freedom and the ability for somebody, a big name, to say, yeah, come on and sit in. Nowadays, it seems like the mentality is no, it's my show. I'm not into the looseness of it. It has to be technically perfect. I need to shine. I need to be the one in the spotlight. Anybody that's going to come in and any type of possible spiritual, that was like a cosmic kind of like, you know, intervention, so to speak. Those things,
yeah.
it's not, it was so, or it just seemed organic, as if they were smiling at you and saying, the spirits have aligned and they brought us Hubert Eves. That's the kind of way it feels. And that's the stuff that's authentic, that's real. And I don't know. It just seems a little. It seems like there's more of a callousness today, and I don't know if that's a de-evolution of humanity or the times we're living in, or just the times that happened to be at that time. But it's pretty magical stuff.
Yeah, well, I would say the difference with that time is because of what was going on, just in general in the country. You know, everybody was trying to. You know, everybody was just loose. Everything politically was loose. It's not like it is now, where everything is tight and you just never know what's, you know, there's so much going on.
Why is it tight, though? Because you have, I mean, I agree with you, but it's so tight, it's so rigid. I mean, is there anything, is it just like a shift in the, is it the world? And why, I mean, I think it was loose then because there was kind of a jump ball. There's a lot of stuff going on, and
yeah,
you know, there was, yeah, you know, there's sort of a variety, but I mean, is it just that why is it tighter now? Is it just, is there anything you can point to?
I would say probably technology.
Yeah.
Technology has gotten everything to the point where, you know, you can make it perfect. And so we proceed to try and make everything perfect. And we make it so perfect that we perfect the life out of it.
They perfect the life out of it. As a result, younger people believe that that's if you fall short of perfection, then you're a failure. That's part of the
issue. Exactly.
That's part of what's going on, because it is so, I mean, this whole trek that I've been on for 3 years is about humanity. I mean, technically, it's about music, but it's about racism, it's about the economy, it's about values, it's about intimacy, it's about the whole damn thing. And it's like, boy, life is imperfect. If you can't accept imperfection, if you can't appreciate imperfection, then that's you're going to have a lot of people dropping out of society, because if you get that tuned up to perfection, it's lunacy takes hold, because nobody's perfect. And so I guess maybe that's a huge imbalance. I think you probably nailed that. And from a music point of view, you know, I mean, I remember guys telling me stories. Charlie Parker would flub a note on an album, but it would stay in the album, you know? I mean, it's there. And I wonder... go ahead.
I want to cut you off. Go ahead.
I mean, basically, it comes down to the fact that, you know, being that you didn't have technology at that time, and that maybe you made up the charts, like you talked about that earlier with... I forget what group it was, but, you know, getting, you know, oh, Otis Redding. It was the Otis Redding thing that you heard. The charts were on the fly. Everybody was listening. And they were feeding off each other, and they'd do one take, and it may not be perfect, but if they dug it and they were feeling good, then it would just carry them through the rest of the album. That's, you know what it is? It's really nice to talk to you, because you lived through a time that probably will not be replicated, but it's important to take some of those values and move them in for my children, your grandkids. You know, I mean, that's kind of what it's about, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and I can refer back again to something that was really insightful to me at the time, and that was, and I go back to the commercial music for a second, when I was with the group Entune, before it was Entune, we were friends, and we were musicians that, you know, kind of dabbled in both R&B and jazz and so forth, and, you know, because it was all kind of starting to blend together,
right?
You know, because of, like, what Miles was doing at the time with Bitches Brew. So, anyway, we were hired once to go in and duplicate the music of some of the hit records from Motown. And what we had to do was duplicate the feel of it, and then it would be used for different soundtracks for, you know, TVs or commercials or whatever. So, and what they would do is they would send over the originals so that we could hear them. And what really kind of, you know, stuck with me was when we would listen to them, you could listen to the vocal tracks of, like, some of the main singers, and you'd hear all kinds of noises in the background, and you'd hear them laughing and telling jokes in between takes and so forth. They left all that stuff in there. And I was like, wow, nobody even knew that. No, you couldn't hear that when you listened to the records, and these were hit records. But yet, when you could have got a chance to be fortunate enough like we was to hear what was really going on, and that's the kind of stuff that made that stuff so live. They kept a lot of that stuff in there. They kept the feel going, because it was more important for the singers to get the feel of something than to make sure that everything was noise, absolute 100% noise free, and so on and so forth. As now, of course, with technology, you know, you can do sing up one chorus of something, and you can copy it and paste it, and so it's perfect every time that you hear that chorus. But yet, you know, life is not like that.
That's the point.
You know,
is that and if music is a reflection of life, then we're living through a very inauthentic time, a very limited time of which is sad to me, you know, and yeah, you could sound terrible singing a vocal, and then the engineer could say, come on, we'll fix it. You know, there's no, and I, someone said it to me before, it's, what has happened to the, I mean, is it really even in the, is it even acknowledged that it's important to be good at an instrument anymore? That's the other part of it, is that I see, because listening has been, we don't listen as well anymore because things are so fast-paced and because, for whatever reason, younger generations are, believe that they, whatever it is, I mean, they just don't listen as much. Therefore, improvisational soul music is not going to be, they're not going to be used to hearing it. I mean, when I went to a club in Long Beach a couple weeks ago to see Azar, Theo Saunders in this band, that Mayuto Correa playing the cuica and six conga drums. It was incredible. And I'm looking around at the younger cats, and I'm just bobbing and weaving to the undulating rhythms, those Afro-Cuban swing rhythms underneath the rhythm section. And I'm looking around, and a lot of the younger kids, they might be enjoying it, but they're not grooving to it because they're just used to digital loops. They're used to the loops. They're used to the beats. There's no space within the music. So that live, the capacity, I think that was the other thing that was so special about this time, is that the Jazz Boat or Folk City or Montreux, there were just so many places to experience and see and hear and play live. And the music that you guys were playing had to be in your ears live. It's really fascinating. I mean, the lack of venues, I think, now also to be able to see any type of music has hurt people's ability to become more sensitive and to feel that.
Yeah, and that's a big part of it, too, the economics of it, because back then in the 70s, you know, there were a lot of jazz clubs around, and once you played in one or two, the owners knew you. So when you would go to the next club just to hang out, oh, come on in.
Right.
No problem. So you got a chance to move around. Once you were established in the so-called clique in terms of musicians, you could move around and you didn't have to be, you know, have to be concerned about the fact that now it's $35 to get in, and it's a two drink minimum.
Right,
and,
right, exactly.
You know, you got to park your car and you pay for it. So you spend $120-$150 a night, you know, to go hang out to see somebody now, almost, you know. But back then, you know, and even as a musician now, but back then it was like, oh, come on in, that's so and so. Oh, come on. So you could got a chance to make the rounds, and all the musicians were doing that, hanging with each other, sitting in with each other, giving each other tips, talking about different stories that they heard. I wouldn't trade that for nothing.
We're talking to Hubert Eaves. I'm having a ball right now. It's July 4th, 2013.
I'm having a ball too. I really am.
I'm jogging your memory. I'm jogging your memory, which I love. I love doing this stuff because, you know, I wanted to ask you: did you, being that you were a drummer, did you have a chance to play with M Boom, with Freddie Waits and Joe Chambers and those guys? I only ask because there was an album I found now you can go to thrift stores and for 50 cents you can find, you know, a Renee McLean album with Hubert Eaves on it, you know, and Freddie Waits was the drummer on that, but I just wasn't sure the drums, the significance of the drums to the history of the music. Tell me about your involvement, if at all, with M Boom or any of the percussionists in the early 70s. I know you were with Bartz, but I mean, you could see, you, obviously, like we've been talking about, you come in contact with those guys.
Yeah. I was in contact with those guys because Freddie had a rehearsal studio in the basement of over on West Street. I forget the name of it, but it was the Artist in Residence building on West Street where, you know, not all, but many, many great musicians lived, and they had some type of grant that subsidized them so that they could stay there.
Wow.
And they always had something going on. But I knew them all, and I never got to play with them because I wasn't of that level as a drummer. I was really an R&B drummer, you know, so that I wasn't in that class. But in terms of rhythm, you know, I knew rhythm. So, you know, my experience was whenever groups that I played in, I always had my own cowbell or tambourine, and I would always, you know, when somebody was soloing or whatever, I'd always try to play if I felt it. But that wasn't something that, you know, I brought into, I keep wanting to say Embu, but it's Embu.
Yeah, no, go ahead. Continue.
It's just been so long since I've said that name that I get confused about it.
But that's what I love about, I love talking to you guys too, because I mean, as artists, you know, here I am kind of going back to a time before I was even alive. And for you guys, as artists, you just continue to move forward in your careers. It's not like you're like thinking back or throwing, when in fact, all I'm listening to is the spiritual stuff. That's all I hear.
Yeah.
You know, so because I can't relate to the digitization of or the technology. I mean, I love technology and it serves a purpose, but there was just realism. I mean, I feel like at that time, the only reason I bring it up is because it seemed to me that Max Roach, I think, you know, I consider him the leader of that, but I've interviewed Warren Smith and Ray Mantia and Joe Chambers. I've interviewed, you know, just trying to get to the idea of the African root in the music. It was imperative, and we talk about this loose scene. I mean, I look at the brotherhood that you were part of, and it just seems like you guys set the tone for that. That the reason it was loose is because you guys were not all caught up in, I need my limo, two drink minimum at the door, park the car, all the superfluous crap. It was just about the music. The music was always above you guys, and you guys knew.
It's funny when you say the limousine.
Yeah.
There were times when I did gigs, and this is as honest to God's truth, where I would go make $50 to do the gig. I had to carry my Fender Rhodes, put it in a cab, and take it, you know, to the gig and back.
Right.
And end up, after paying the cab fare, with a sore back, and which I have to this day, and $15. So, $35 worth of cab fare. To make $15 to play.
Right.
Obviously that wasn't an every gig type situation, but there were times that did happen.
Go ahead. I mean, there's a fine line between, you know, you talk to some guys and they're like, I didn't want to be a starving genius. So they made decisions, you know, that were economically in their best interest. And, I mean, you've been very prolific
I did make that decision, too, though. I've got to be honest with you.
I know. Go ahead. So when you made that decision, I mean, it was just a matter of survival, really.
Yeah, I mean, because of the times that I came up in, I saw a lot of great, great musicians. And I had friends that were personal friends that were piano players that went off the deep end mentally.
Right.
Because the music, you know, who knows if they had, you know, if they had mental situations that were negative, whether they, you know, if they hadn't been in music. But the fact that I knew them through the music and they would have certain type problems that some of them couldn't overcome. And, you know, ended up in mental hospitals and so forth, or drank themselves to death, or, you know, drugged themselves and so forth, or couldn't handle women. And, you know, there were just different things that was going on that were to the detriment of their life. And I saw that, you know, playing and right up into my face, because those are the type of musicians that I loved and appreciated, the ones that would take the chances, the ones that were really the creative ones. You know, I was not about the ones that were, you know, anyway, I'll just say that those are the kind of people I like.
Absolutely, I get you, I feel you.
I was faced with that kind of a challenge. I was consciously faced with, not the fact that I considered myself a genius or anything by any means, I'm not saying that, but I could see the walk. I could see the vision that they were seeing. they painted that picture, and I could see it, and I would look at my family, and I would say, I can't do that. I'm not going to go through that. And what happened was, even though I appreciated the music and so forth, I remember getting a gig with Roberta Flack, this was later, and she hired me she came in, we went to a rehearsal, that's what it was. And I remember making $60 just to do a rehearsal. And at that time, I was like, wow, that's more than the gigs that I've been making. You know what I mean? I didn't have to bring a piano in. Uh-huh. I didn't have to bring in anything. I could just walk in and do it. And I was like, and then as I worked with her, I started making more like $300 to do one concert, $350, mm-hmm. one concert. Mm-hmm. And that's like, you know, 4 or 5 gigs. You know, and plus, you know, you don't carry anything. All expenses are paid. And I'm like, oh, my God. So once I got exposed to that type of level, of course, she was just, it wasn't, everyone wasn't like that. But she, and once I got exposed to that, I started thinking more economically about, you know, how I could make the most out of what I was doing.
Right.
But yet, in my heart and soul, always was, and still is, and will always be, to the grave, that creative, that appreciation for just the pure spirituality and African rhythms and all of the different aspects of music, just great music, and, you know, that never leaves.
When
people say you sell out, I never sell that.
Right, no, so exactly. I mean, because I really don't want to... you know, this is not about selling out. It's just, it was just, to me, you guys were the last vestige of where you, like I said, you were touched by those unheralded cats, the genius cats with the vision, who, like you said, they would go to the deep end because they were geniuses and they really weren't being, you know, for a variety of reasons, they weren't being acknowledged, whether it was, you know, and so they turned to drugs or the, you know, whatever it is. It's so nice to hear that will always be who you are. And I know you're doing a solo project now, but again, that speaks to the idea of saying, well, if you feel that soul so deep, why not go out and reach out to like-minded people and play? I mean, was it just something that you felt like you wanted to do a solo thing, or do you still play with some of your brotherhood?
Oh no, no. When I say solo, I just meant under my name.
Under your name. So who's on?
Yeah, that could be a trio. That could be a quartet. That could be a band. You know, it could be some of the brotherhood. Yeah, I'm not. I don't mean just me. From that standpoint, no.
Right. So this.
In other words, I did an album in 1973. Right. That's the last. No, I'm sorry. 76. That's the only album I've ever done under my name.
What was the name of it?
It's called Esoteric Funk.
Okay. I was reading about that last night. It was a fascinating review of that. I have never seen that album.
Yeah. In fact, that album, the last time I checked it on Amazon, it was like $180.
Oh, you have no idea. Dude, you have no... See, that's where... But see, Hubert, here's another issue that I am curious about, because you work... You're on both sides of the fence. You know, one of the reasons that there was such a commerce base around the record industry when you first got to New York, even before that, and... The only reason I'm even aware of you and Stafford and Howard King and Bartz is because the records gave you guys an identity. There were pictures, there were liner notes, and of course there was there was the music. And so, I mean, that to me is really special. If you were able to carve out an identity and even get to the point where they could say, okay, Hubert, Esoteric Funk, you know, that's your, you know, let's get your name on that. And I just wonder today, you know, how people, accompanists were given individuality. That's the thing. That to me spoke to the team concept. Everybody was given an identity. Where now is just, if it's Beyonce, it's just Beyonce. It doesn't matter if there's 30 cats behind her playing. she's getting the recognition, but not the accompanists. That is a saddening thing to me, because that's the whole reason that improvisation, melodic invention works, is because everyone's working within that team concept, you know. And I don't know why that's gotten, or why more people aren't picking up on that, because that hurts the ability for the improvisational music.
Well, I must say this in defense.
Go ahead.
Of
yeah.
In defense of creativity, there are some people trying to break through. You know, there are a lot of like-minded people who feel like you and me, in a sense that, you know, there's got to be a solution to it, and creativity has no rules. You just go for it. You go with what you feel and what you know, which just convicts you in your heart and soul. And there are people doing it. There's some young people doing it who have appreciated the old standard that has, you know, who laid the groundwork. The Thelonious Monks and Miles Davis and Bill Evans and different people who were original with the way that they approach things. So they're trying, and it's going to take. I know this is a bold statement.
Yeah,
I know it, but I'm really saying it to myself, probably more than anyone, and that is, it's going to take guys like me to try to bridge it, to try to bridge that gap. And not to say that I'm the only one that, no, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that there are other guys out there that are doing it, trying to do it, and just as God has made each and every one of us, individual and given us our own unique fingerprints and all, we each have our own ways and approaches and stories to tell. I have to tell mine based on what my background and experiences are, just as you have to do as you're doing as a writer, which is different than someone else who's a writer. So we all have to contribute and try to do what we can to just keep pushing it.
No, I really liked what you're saying. It's just it's trying to figure out how to create a system that will be effective. I agree with you, because you guys are that's one reason I reached out to you guys. I mean, I started my radio program on AM radio in January of 2011, and I was going to do stuff on, you know, topical stuff related to, you know, immigration, education. You know, I love Tucson. I love living here. But after about 3 months, I was like, this is whack. I'm like, nobody really wants to solve these problems. I can't get any truth out of anybody, and I really don't want to do this stuff anymore. So I was like, you know, what do I love? I said, I love my kids. I love my wife. I love my, and I look at all these LPs I have from the early 1970s. I said, let me reach in and pull these guys out. And started with Pat Martino, went to the Skipper, on to, you know, Lou Tobakin and, you know, Ayerto and Candido and Bob Batunde and Gary Bartz, and now it's up to Hubert Eves. And it's like, you guys are the most real people I know. And I go see you guys, and I think that's one of the things, the best advice I could give you as a listener and as a journalist is just, if you're playing live, because that's what this music is, it has to be live, that in between the standards or Hubert Eves original, Mama Soul or whatever, talk to the audience, not even about the technical stuff. Talk about the love. Talk about the Thelonious Monk story. Those stories will resonate. To me, it's a different system now. You can't just, it's not like you can walk into a club and see McCoy time. McCoy's not going to walk in on his birthday and someone's going to be able to play, Enlightenment for him or something like that. So it's a different way of trying to educate and that bridge. And I saw it with Azar and the Skipper and Alphonse, they're doing it. I mean, those you guys, it's almost like a bell kind of is going off. Now is the time. If not, it's going to be gone.
Yeah. That's interesting. That's really interesting that you say that, because it's so on point. And a friend of mine, he was the manager of McCoy Tyner at one point. I think he even might have managed Azar. And his name is Jack Walker. He
yes.
was with us with Gary Bartz in Montreal. But anyway, he had asked me if I wanted to go see Azar, go here and play live. And I had to do something. I can't remember what it was, and I passed on it. And I remember him calling me the next day, and he was saying the same thing. He said, he's really carrying it on. He's really doing it.
I'm telling you right now, I sat down with him at a chicken and there was a club called the Seabird in Long Beach 2 weeks ago, and he wrapped up the gig with these first ballot hall from the Brotherhood, first ballot Hall of Fame guys, just swung so hard. And I was alluding to that 73 Montreux concert, I think specifically of your quartet, and I think of McCoy's quartet. What he's doing that is totally awesome, and he's putting together an East Coast band and a West Coast band. And he's putting together bands. They've had a residency there for 9 months. Granted, it's only one. Maybe it's on the weekends. It's only three nights a week. It's not six or seven. But the idea of the live band, a consistent live band, is really pretty compelling, because that's what made it flourish back at that time. Again, the records were the commerce was there. But it was the loyalty. You could see and feel and hear that authenticity. It was real. And so he's going back to that, and he's trying to push that forward in his own way. And I find that to be extremely, I mean, easier said than done. I mean, but that's the first part. You have to play it live, because the younger cats have to start hearing the stuff live, because everything's digital. They don't hear the silence. They don't hear the music in the silence. So you keep putting it live in their ears. And again, we're talking New York is still on fire, and there's parts of Southern California. But, I mean, you know, you think about it, even Minnesota had its own scene. Now, you said you did outgrow that scene at a certain point. You know, you outgrew the musicians, and you were just ready to grow. And I think that was, but, I mean, think about that. We don't have that kind of regional activity anymore. So it's the way Hubert Eaves needs to get out in public and talk. You know what I'm trying to say? Like that, people need to hear from you guys, because you're not, you especially have been on both sides of this fence. You know, you've done the commercial, but you live in the spiritual. And that to me is, you know, how do you use your spirituality? How do you show love? How do you incorporate that into the music? Younger generations did not grow up in the civil rights movement, didn't grow up during a different time. So we're sort of, you know, trying to figure out why we're muddled, when in fact we always have been muddled. And it takes genius and it takes selflessness to pass that on, which is why I've, you know, gone after you guys, you know?
There's a reason, a definite reason, why the rappers use samples of the 70s and of the greats, whoever they may be. There's a reason, and it's because of the feel. They can't get that using straight up drum machines.
That's right.
And I give them credit for that. And that's the benefit of being able to walk in both worlds, because you know you can hear where what they're trying to do. They still hear it. They appreciate it, and they use it in the best way they know how. And some of them are really, really good at it, and even great at it. So you know, music is just too vast to be locked into one thing. You know, creativity is just too much. And you know. Even as we speak with this whole interview, I have tears in my eyes.
I think
of the spirituality that's involved in what I feel in terms of, you know, what it does to me. And I can only speak for myself, but I do know that there are a lot of us.
There's a lot more.
A lot of them fell by the wayside. A lot of them, you know, because of the problems and, like I said, with economics or relationships and spirituality or lack of and so forth. You know, some of them will be coming back around later after they've gone through the cleanse that they need to go through. You know, I was one of the fortunate ones you know, I have a family. Like I said, I've kept for 48 years, and my son plays, my daughter's creative, so forth. I was one of the fortunate, and I really feel blessed for that. But I've had too many people that I know of, but much more talent than me. Much more, you know, if there's a scale to measure, you know. But they, for some reason, you know, have had a lot of things that they've had to deal with that I didn't have to deal with. And so I totally feel blessed with that. So the best thing that I can do is to try to bring forth inspiration to other folks, young folks, or just anybody who's willing to listen and just tell my own story of how I was blessed. And to, you know, and that means going back to, you know, back to the barbershop, working in my dad's barbershop and hearing Miles Davis and, you know, John Coltrane and James Brown and B.B. King.
Right.
And, you know, so that's my responsibility. I take that on.
I this is so righteous. You know, it's like before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. You know, head back to the, you know, and that's again speaking. I'm just, you know, I'm just like kind of like you, wide eyed. You know, with being able to sort of do an outside in. You know, gain the loyalty and the trust of the musicians themselves, and talk to you guys on this level. But you know. What kind of neighborhood are you going to go back to? You know, I mean, how to me, the neighborhoods, especially the African American neighborhoods now, you don't have those small newspapers covering, you know, like you had the Pittsburgh Courier or the Detroit Navigator. You had, you know, newspapers that appreciated what the music was and they covered it. And I don't know what you'd go back to now. You know, it's kind of across the board, you talk about people falling off the wagon, but in a lot of ways, the nuclear family has also gone by the wayside. And you lose that unit, and you lose that stability, and, I think it's important for you to go and see what's there now. Maybe you do, I don't know. But that, to me, is essential, because you need to have the rappers playing, still appreciating instruments and learning how to play. That's the thing. You got that the rappers are, they just stopped playing it. They didn't start playing it. They stopped playing instruments. So they're taking all the stuff, all the samples from the early 70s. And it's like, well, okay, but where's the improvisational bridge? Where's the melodic bridge from then? You know, and that's I don't do you teach kids piano? Do you do any teaching at all?
No, mostly because I'm still learning.
Yes, the enlightened one. That's beautiful. That is what have you learned today?
Actually, one of the main things that I've learned, especially with this conversation, is I'm making sure that I'm focused on not doing some of the things that we're talking about, that in terms of the music, and making sure that I bring forth that creativity, that the things that we spoke about of the early days, the acousticness of it, the camaraderie of it, because I'm doing a couple of different projects, and I want to make sure that I bring the best and the most authentic forth of whatever it is. You know what I mean? In other words, I'm doing a jazz project, which is going to involve different players. And I'm also going to do an R&B dance project that's going to involve players. But to bring the best forth, so that the creativity is still there, because it's just music. It's still there. It's the people, you know, you can take one person who is a great approach and who's very charismatic and who's very, you know, creative and melodic and all of those things. That's one thing. But then if you take four other or five other people who are like-minded, then you've got, you know, unlimited source. And I want to, that's the thing that I want to focus on, and this conversation has helped me to make sure that I